and welcome to the second in the series of My Icon podcast.
So you're agreeing with that? It is My Icon, yeah?
No, not at all. I'm going to expand upon that. So at our last opening inaugural conversation, you came up with My Icon podcast, and you don't know who the My is in that.
Well, I do, actually. It's My as in the broad company and everybody associated with Icon.
Welcome to our next My Icon person, then, somebody who is very much associated with Icon, and I'm sure he can expand on how and why. My name's Darren Capon. I'm one of the owners and founders of Icon Solutions, and you are Tom?
I'm Tom Kelleher, also one of the co-founders and owners of Icon.
Right, well, now let's find out who the My is in today's podcast. Caller, who are you?
Well, I am not one of the co-founders of Icon, but it is Lee McNabb. I am at NatWest Group. I am the head of our group strategy and partnership function, and know Tom and Darren very well and the Icon guys very well. They are fundamental to what we are doing strategically here at NatWest, and we also have a minority stake, and I have the pleasure of being a board observer.
Pleasure. There we go. You see, there's an invite to anybody else who wishes to invest and come along and see what happens at our board meetings. Before we start talking about your professional career, though, Lee, do you want to give us some background as to some interesting facts about yourself, particularly because Tom is a Spurs supporter? Let's talk about Liverpool for a bit.
Do you really want to go down games that Spurs have been involved in, Tom? Because we can if you like.
Let's swiftly moving on. No, definitely not. No. Go on.
So I am from the northwest of England. My heritage is in Liverpool. I still live near to Liverpool now. I'm a big Liverpool fan. I am very happily married. I've got two wonderful children who are now my main love. My other love is football, always has been, always played, and always watched Liverpool. And I've been lucky to see Liverpool win many trophies, been to see them all over Europe. And so, yeah, I've enjoyed that side of my life with a great passion. And although I don't get to go as much as I used to, obviously, with kids and work, etc., I still go when I can.
Superb. But when you say all over Europe, am I right in thinking you were at the game in Europe, Lee?
The game in Europe. Yes, I was at the game in Europe. And it's funny because I still play on a Saturday and coach the team. And I was talking to a lad who was born in 2006. And I said, well, I was in Istanbul in 2005. And it made me very depressed because it made me realize how old I am. But yes, I was very fortunate to be in Istanbul. Me with one of my best mates and obviously about 40,000 other Liverpool fans that had made the journey over to Turkey to watch, I think, arguably the best, unless you're an AC Milan fan, arguably the best European Cup final, in which we managed to win on penalties after being down 3-0 at half-time. I did also go to Athens a couple of years later against AC Milan, which wasn't as positive an outcome, but we'll gloss over that one.
Well, yeah, we best do. But we can talk about the final when we beat Spurs a bit later. But anyway, we're not here to talk about football. America seems to have featured quite a bit in your upbringing. Were you there for long? What was the story around your US?
Yeah, I've got quite a potted history with the US, to be fair. Traveling there plenty of times when I was a kid. But then I actually met my wonderful wife, who I've been with for about 22 years, married for about 15, in America at Camp America in Minnesota. She was at Liverpool University. It was a Liverpool-based company. Obviously, I was here anyway. And then we met over in America. We traveled after we met. We went to New York on a 28-hour bus journey from Minnesota to New York, which is arguably the worst journey I've ever done in my life.
Sounds like London to Liverpool in this country.
Yeah. It was more efficient and on time than a certain train service that carries me up and down from London. But I won't name names. But yeah, it was a special memory, and I've also worked there as a coach. So I've worked all across the West Coast of America, from San Diego right the way up, all across the West Coast, Arizona, Vegas, Palm Springs, Santa Barbara, LA. How high did I go? I didn't go as high as San Francisco, but yeah, I know the West Coast of America very well.
Superb. I spent 15 minutes on a bike with my a tandem with my wife, and if it had been 20 minutes, we wouldn't be married any longer. So, I spent an hour in a car with Lee, and that was enough for me. But there we go. So, Was any of that in banking careers, or was that all your coaching and stuff out in America?
Yeah, that was all prior to the career in banking. I had a stint when I got back from America, working in an engineering firm, funnily enough, which was my granddad's. He started his company when he was about 15. It was it's effectively printing, guillotine blades, sharpening, but he did printing supplies as well, and he actually grew it himself. So like you guys, he grew it himself from a small solo operation in the back room of another factory to £1 million turnover at its peak. The industry died a bit more recently, but yeah, that was in the family originally. So I worked for him for a bit, and then I thought, actually, I need something a bit more challenging in many ways, maybe a bit more white collar than blue collar. And so got into banking, started probably 20 years ago, maybe 18, 19 years ago. And I started my career at Cooperative Bank, a much smaller UK bank, but still a high street lender and a clearer from a payments perspective.
So what did you do Lee, during the co-op? What did you start at? What was the sort of the journey?
I started off in mortgages. And it's a bit of a basic rationale, really. One of my good friends was a mortgage salesman. I'd done my degree, first person in my family to do a degree, which I was very proud of. But I'll be honest, Tom, I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do with that degree. So I went into banking primarily because one of my good friends was earning quite good money from being a mortgage salesman, and that co-op were putting you through it was CMAP at the time. So I thought, oh, I'll join there. I used to work there in a glass pyramid, which was based in Stockport, which is no longer part of the cooperative property, but it was literally what it says, a glass pyramid. I started in mortgage, like post-service, if you like, got my CMAP, became an advisor, and then kind of had a couple of routes as an option, go into team management, which they wanted me to do, but I kind of had my eyes on different things, wanted to be more in the head office, and so ended up getting a secondment, funnily enough, not in the mortgage team. I went for an interview as a mortgage product consultant, but hey, the HR department put me in the wrong interview, and they didn't realize that was the case until I'd done an hour of competency-based assessment. And when they started to ask me technical questions about current accounts and savings accounts, I was like, I don't really have an idea other than having one. And the lady who's interviewing me, I did think why all your examples were mortgage based. And I was like, well, that's because it's the mortgage product consultant role. To which she replied, no, it isn't. Can you please just leave the room a second while we try and sort out what to go next? But as fate would have it, and I'm a big believer in fate, I'd passed the competency. I was asked whether I was still keen on going forward to the technical detail, which I was, because it was a slightly longer secondment than the mortgage one. I interviewed for the mortgage one and this one, and decided that my future lay in the initial aspect in current accounts and savings. And then I've not looked back since. Worked across all product types, savings, business, current accounts, went back into mortgages for a bit, unsecured lending, and then got in payments. So a role was created for me towards the end of my tenure at Co-op to lead like payment strategy and implementation. So there was no one really looking at the strategic direction of payments. It was very much a scheme-led piece, but almost from a BAU reg compliance angle, as opposed to where are we going with this. It was at the time when Apple Pay was starting to emerge. I believe when Apple initially contacted the kind of scheme team at Co-op, they said, well, we're not interested. But purely that's because that their role was operational and service-based and industry-based. So that was probably about 10 years ago.
Crikey. So is that the point then at which you moved on to your next bank?
Yeah, so that's probably about 6 years ago. I spent the first few years kind of shaping what the payment strategy would be for Co-op. I was responsible for implementation of PSD2, so the Payment Services Directive 2. I was responsible for the scheme relationship with the card scheme, so it was Visa. I was responsible for the implementation of the pays. So it was Android Pay at the time and Apple Pay, Android Pay, now Google Pay, obviously, and kind of all things generic payments. So not necessarily the kind of nuts and bolts and the technical delivery, but kind of the overarching product propositional strategic view. And then I was approached by an old colleague, actually. There was an opportunity to join NatWest RBS, but it was actually only an internal role, but they wanted to speak to me. And I did. And after a quite elongated and challenging interview process, I joined NatWest RBS 6.5 years ago. And since then, I've looked after strategy, innovation, and now sit on our payments exco.
So I think we'd probably started at Icon at NatWest just before you then. I think we were doing that sort of payments tech strategy.
It was, do you know what? I think you may have done with Ian, but then if I recall, one of the first tasks I had was working closely with you guys to do the tech strategy for our previous kind of head of payments, so Marion at the time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So paths did cross, but I don't think it was with yourselves.
So that angle that you bring to the piece then, as you said to us in the past when we've spoken, you're not a technology person. So when we speak, and you know, as an observer on the board, there's two things that I think you bring to the party when we're having our conversations. One is around the risk and control elements, because that seems to be a passion for yours. And the other then is around how all of this change can actually help to deliver better services to the customers. Would that be a fair interpretation of how you see your role, both with us and at NatWest?
Yeah, it is. And the risk side is partly because during my career at Co-op, I led the first line risk team. So I've always got that lens. Although risk, my conclusion of working in risk is that, yes, it's massively important, but it's just common sense most of the time. And the decisions that people make that are probably more laden with risk kind of are absent of any common sense. But yeah, having had a history and kind of first line product, if you like, so dealing directly with customer journeys, experience, my line is always, well, what are the customer outcomes? Where is the customer benefit? What are we working towards? How is the technology an enabler towards the betterment of that customer experience? So yeah, I'd like to think that's something different that I can bring to the table compared to, say, Ian, for example, who's your other board observer from NatWest, who is very much kind of technical and delivery based. I think we're a good kind of yin and yang.
It's certainly been, great fun to get you on board and to work alongside you. So given that, what at the moment is the thing that most excites you as to where payments is going to be in 2, 3, 4 years time?
Ooh, that's a great question. You know, we spent quite a bit of time the last couple of days considering that. I've just come from a meet. I've actually traveled up from London to make it back for this podcast. But this morning I was with our CFO, Katie Murray, with my boss, Mark Brandt, who's our chief payment officer. And we were talking about that very question. The UK is in a bit of I would call it a flux at this moment in time, because I think strategically we don't know what we want to be. And that's kind of a UK PLC question and challenge. We had the HMT focus led by Joe Garner, who's the former CEO of Nationwide. And his kind of conclusion was, look, there's good stuff here, but ultimately we need improvements in experience and security, some of the open banking elements, and the industry is lacking almost a North Star or a vision. We've had the Bank of England recently release its discussion paper on innovation in money and payments. You've got privately led initiatives like the Regulated Liability Network that we as a group have been funding participants of. So there's almost these kind of multiple pieces of the puzzle. We don't quite know what the picture on the puzzle is. We don't quite know what all the pieces are, but we need to work as an industry, private, public collaboration, not just the peer banks, with fintechs and technology providers like yourselves, with competitors, with big tech, with the regulators, and work out, well, what do we want to be when we grow up? I think at one time the UK was leading. Think about faster payments, 12 years ago plus. But I think now others have caught up and almost taken over. And so I think the UK has this kind of this strategic question it needs to answer.
So you kind of, the bank needs to be ready for whatever's going to come down the line in the future. And part of that is making sure that you've got the flexibility, that you've got this modern environment in which to be able to adapt. Just interested to get your view on how big that journey has been for NatWest, that task to get yourselves into a much more modern state.
It's been a monumental one, Tom. It's a great question, to be fair. When I joined, 6.5 years ago, we were already on that journey. the journey of payments modernization. And I think every big bank that's been around for the decades that they have faces the same challenge. Slightly creaking infrastructure, dealing with increasing load is a non-technologist way of articulating. I mean, I think in the UK we might make about 100,000 transactions a minute. I mean, there'll probably be 3 million payments made during this podcast. I mean, staggering numbers, really. RTGS, again, I was with the Bank of England recently, RTGS, the real-time gross settlement, I think they process £750 billion a day. I mean, these numbers are huge. We're doing trillions in value each way as an organization ourselves. So the need to constantly improve from a resilience perspective, from an efficiency perspective, is ever present. And it's an ongoing journey. It's not a, well, we'll be done in a year or so. It's an ongoing modernization approach. It's a big strategic focus of ours. And you guys are kind of front and center of that, as you know, as we go through a compliance and simplification journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our view has always been, certainly with IPF, is to put that control back in the bank's hands, you know, to almost take back control of your payments infrastructure, because you don't know what's coming down the line. You're going to have to adapt and change to different circumstances, be there industry pressures, what the competition are up to, or the regulatory sort of demands going forward. You didn't take an approach to sort of build this yourself from scratch. You kind of you used as tools, smart tools out in the marketplace in order to help you accelerate that. And obviously you've used IPF. How has that helped you move you know, your ideas forward and modernize?
I think you said it yourself, right? There's almost a sweet spot between buy and build. And I think that's where Icon and IPF kind of hits that sweet spot. I think banks in the past, through my experience, goes through cycles, and those cycles are, oh, we're going to build it all ourselves because we're a big bank and we know better than everyone else. And then it's almost, oh, we can't build anything because ultimately we don't have the resource, capacity, capability to do that. And I think now we're in a position where we should seek partnership first. If someone's out there that can do something better than we can, more efficiently than we can, then we shouldn't be afraid of that. And again, your IPF solution is almost like that sweet spot between you giving us the control, the empowerment, I would say, with the relevant framework and guardrails and ultimately kind of scheme element within the packs that you've got, to then implement as efficiently as we can. To your point, to set ourselves up for the future, it's important that we don't build ourselves into cul-de-sacs. A lot of my work is on the future of payments at a UK level. That is a future of tokenization. It's a future of increased digitization. It's a future where technology is going to evolve more rapidly. I don't drink the Kool-Aid on things like DLT, but I'm also not naive to think that it's not going to have some element of where we play. And we as an institution are experimenters in that space. We're part of RLN. We're part of the BIS global project, Agora, looking at cross-border movement of money. All that will need to integrate into what we have as infrastructure. And that's where what you guys do and what we do collaboratively is really important, because it's about setting yourselves up so in 5 years, you don't go, right, we need to another core modernization because something else has come along.
So do you now start to view the payments landscape as a cost on being in business, a tax on being a bank? Or is it now starting to get to a point where you think via innovation, you can almost start to make it a profit center or a thing that can allow you to go out to new markets?
It's a very hot topic, Darren, to be fair. When I joined, we were part of the services function. We were almost, payments was almost the plumbing. It's old school language, right? But I think at an industry level, it was seen as the plumbing. And we, along with many others, have almost said, well, actually, payments is your most important part of the bank. Banks only do three things, right? They move money, they hold money, they lend money. Simple as that. And we overcomplicate it. The movement of money is fundamentally linked to the holding of money. And that movement of money is payments. And your infrastructure needs to be fit for purpose to ensure that it can improve customer experience, be as profitable as it can be as efficient as it can be. Because ultimately it's fundamentally important to what a bank does and how we do it. So yeah, the narrative has definitely changed to how we can almost create payments as a business to market. And we already do it, right? We already do and provide payments for other corporates, for other banks and financial institutions who want access into the scheme. We provide FX for corporates on a global scale. We provide acquiring where acquiring is needed. We provide open banking services where that's needed. But we are on a bit of a journey to ensure that that infrastructure centrally is ring-fenced and as secure and as flexible and as adaptable and scalable as it can be, so that we can increase speed to market and increase innovation and meet customer need as it evolves.
And the regulation, which I think is driving a lot of the innovation, the regulation around resiliency, I think, is becoming an interesting and hot topic. How are you viewing that within NatWest?
I mean, resilience in payments involves ensuring that reliability, security, continuity of payment systems, despite disruptions, are kind of key. And a resilient payment infrastructure can absorb shocks and continue operations during challenges like cyber attacks or hardware failures. I mentioned some of the stats earlier. No one thanks you in an organization like ours when a payment is made. But if a payment is not made quite quickly, the phone is picked up. You're like, why is this not happening? What is going on? So that resiliency part is kind of front and center of what we do. The compliance piece will never go away. I mentioned PSD2 earlier. We're facing into PSD3. We're currently trying to be like everyone else, be compliant with the ISO standards. That's a resiliency drive. That's a straight-through processing and efficiency drive, right? That's a global piece of interoperability that everyone needs to do. In the UK, the account-to-account infrastructure is been challenged and questioned from a resiliency perspective. The MPA was paused under the HMT work. That will likely re-emerge in some form or guise. We have conversations with the Bank of England. They have concerns around resiliency and fallback. We are in the UK very reliant on cards. It's not a bad thing. But where's the fallback, right? As cash has diminished to 4% of money transmission in the UK, what if the card schemes go down? What do we do? So all that debate links to resiliency effectively. And until you get those resilient fallbacks, you can't truly innovate.
No. And there is, of course, a danger that the cost of being resilient is going to sort of have the counter effect of driving the smaller players back to the margins, having spent a lot of time trying to make open banking and get more players in the market. You know, it's just where do we set the bar so that we don't make it too difficult and too expensive to clear the bars that you're talking about?
The balance between open access and competition innovation has arguably never been important. The regulator wants a competitive market, wants an open access market, which is absolutely fine. But actually, you'll find that some providers don't want that. Some providers leverage and welcome the comfort of a larger institution, giving them the security of their payments and the kind of trust framework and the regulatory compliance. So, whilst the regulator might aspire to have that fully open market, for some, it isn't always the answer.
I'm going to hand over to Mr. My Icon Podcast, Tom himself, for some closing statements. But
thank you.
Thank you, Lee, for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Darren. Appreciate that.
It's lovely. I've enjoyed being on your podcast.
So I do one area I wanted to just pick up on, Lee. You know, we had the investment from NatWest into Icon earlier this year. I think the press release went out around March time. And we're delighted that yourself and Ian Povey have joined the board as observers. That's it's been great to have you on board. But I'm just really interested in your observation so far over the past 6 months. Obviously, you've worked for big financial institutions, and now you're very much involved with us. And we're a small to medium sized fintech. What's the observations? What are the things that you've found that have been of interest?
I think the big thing for us, obviously, it's a complicated process to go through an investment in anybody, right? I've had experience of it before. But this was another learning curve. But I think the thing that stood out for us was it's not just the kind of the innovative approach to the framework you guys have got with IPF. It's not just the knowledge you guys have got as industry veterans, and I use the word veterans in the kindest of ways, obviously, Darren. but it's a culture you guys have as well within the organization. Ultimately, when you do a deal like this, even if you ignore the deal and you go for just the partnership places, the supplier place, you want to be able to look into people's eyes and know you're getting full and transparent, honest responses to challenges, because these things aren't easy. We know full well there's going to be bumps in the road when it comes to a piece of work that is so substantial in scale and size. But with you guys, we know we have that real, honest, open relationship. And it's a partnership, right? It was a partnership before the investment. It's not just a deeper partnership now we've made the investment. We want you to succeed. You want us to succeed. You want all your customers to succeed. And I think that cultural stance that you take really stands you apart from others. It's not just about the tech. We know that works. It's not just about the framework. It's the people that are behind it as well. And we're a big people, purpose-focused organization. And that kind of stood out when we were going through the process for the investment.
That's great to get that observation, Lee. And I do think it cuts both ways. I think over the years, the relationship has matured, and there is that more of a partnership working together to achieve the goals that have been set out, rather than it be a sort of, you know, bank vendor relationship where, you know, you do what you're told kind of thing. It's not like that at all. It's much more collaborative and effective. And I think that leads to, you know, people sort of working with each other for each other in order to achieve those goals. So, you know, I think we're quite proud of sort of changing the atmosphere and the attitude that has persisted perhaps sometimes with maybe some, you know, larger technology organizations.
Yeah, completely. It's that the flexibility was probably the word that I missed out there as well, because it is you want and need us to succeed, right? Equally, we want and need you to succeed. And it's such a complex market. We've covered it in the past 20, 30 minutes. Change is ever present, and having the adaptability, sorry, can't get my teeth in, and flexibility to make that change is super important. Like when we talk about payments at an executive level, we're still, to Darren's point earlier, we still bring a big investment ask with us because of the need to future-proof and the need to be compliant. And the question was, well, why are we doing this and what are we getting from it? And when we were doing the investment, similar questions were being asked, and do we have real conviction behind this? And we do, otherwise we wouldn't have gone through the investment and the numerous gates, as you can well imagine, that we needed to go through to get that investment over the line.
Excellent. Look, Lee, I think our time is out. We're over 30 minutes now, but look, it's been a pleasure talking to you, albeit remotely. This is our second session on My Icon podcast, which I think has been very successful, you know, despite the naysayers. And, you know, and thank you very much, Darren, for hosting it. I think he's done a wonderful job.
I think I'm getting the hang of it now. Now I'm getting your pronoun descriptions of what we're up to. I'm thinking it all makes perfect sense.
I'm just a bit confused. Is it Darren's podcast or Tom? Sorry, I can't get it.
Today it was yours. And you were a superb host for Tom and I having this here. So always great to talk to you. Can't wait to give you a hug when we next see you. But thank you so much for agreeing to do this, Lee. As always, very articulate, very entertaining. And I'm looking forward to the rest of our journey as we carry on the partnership, as we grow IPF and NatWest together. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.